Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have on the program New York writer Naheed Rocklin. We met her first in Port Townsend when she taught at Centrum years ago, and since then she's published a lot more books. She attended the Columbia University Writing Program on a double-day Columbia Fellowship, and then attended Stanford University's Writing Program on a Wallace Stegner Fellowship. Her publications to date include a memoir, Persian Girls, novels that include Jumping Over Fire from City Lights, Foreigner from W.W. Norton, and Married to a Stranger from E.P. Dutton. She has an online novella, Crowd of Sorrows, which we'll hear more about, and a new book coming out in November 2018, which is her new short story collection, A Way Home. Her work has been individually published in many magazines, including the Virginia Quarterly Review, Prairie Schooner, Red Book, Shenandoah. One of her stories was chosen by Symphony Space Selected Shorts and was aired on NPRs around the country. And three stories have been nominated for the Pushcart Prize. She has written reviews and essays for New York Times, Newsday, Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times. She's received grants and awards from many places, including Penn Syndicated Fiction Project and a National Endowment for the Arts grant. She's taught creative writing at Barnard College, Yale University, and at a wide variety of writers' conferences, including, of course, Centrum, as well as the Paris Writers' Conference, Geneva Writers' Conference, and the Yale Writers' Conference. Her website is www.naheedrocklin.com, and you spell that N-A-H-I-D-R-A-C-H-L-I-N. Welcome to the program, Naheed.
Thank you. It's nice hearing your voice again.
I really remember our fortuitous meeting when I was at Centrum, and I think I was just visiting that year working on a book about writers' journals, and just wandered around, and you and I took a wonderful walk on a very hot and sunny day, and we really got to know each other, which was great fun. And today I get to talk to you more about what's happened in all these years. You have written in this decade since we met, or maybe even over a decade, gone from writing fiction to writing memoir, back to short fiction after novels. And one of the things I really remember so well is that you had to write your personal story as a fiction, many short stories first, before you could tackle it as a memoir. And I wonder if you might want to say something to us about that and how your craft of fiction has influenced memoir writing.
The craft of fiction, actually, I think, is more or less the same as, to my opinion, applied to memoir writing, because everybody has an interesting life that they want to draw from, and they're maybe compelled to write about certain aspect of it. But if they're not famous or celebrities, like, say, Hillary Clinton or Jane Fonda or anyone that people are automatically interested in their lives, they have to really work just as hard to make their own life story to be as interesting as reading a novel. They have to use the same techniques as how you put a whole long, large lifetime experiences that you're trying to condense into this memoir. What's your focus? What's your storyline? Where do you start? Where do you end? The structure is just as important in a memoir as it is in a novel. Characterization is just as important. The voice of the narrator is just as important. So I think writing a memoir, you have to basically, as I said, if you're not already a celebrity, you have to engage the reader with the same techniques and the same craft as you do with fiction, to engage the reader in your story. And the reason I suddenly switched at that point to write that memoir was that my sister that I was so close to had died. And because it was under such strange circumstances, I had to go to Iran and try to find out what happened to her. She had been very depressed, and I wondered if it was suicide. But as it turned out, it wasn't after my search. But I felt I needed to bring her back to life somehow for myself and my readers. And I thought the best way to do that, write it as a memoir rather than fiction. It's more like people would look at it, this was a real life story, which it was.
It must have been very hard to write, because I read it and I know how hard her life was. and how much you felt for her.
Right. It was very heart-wrenching, but I still felt good that I wrote it, and, you know, it was a relief to have put it all down on paper.
Yes, and then she exists now, too, on paper,
exactly.
and very vividly.
For other people who read it.
I know that as the surviving sister, survivor's guilt, you were able to escape a life that was the life that was depressing her, and you were able to leave and have a different life, and that must have been something in the balance, too, that
exactly.
And sadness. It's a beautiful book, Persian Girls, and I really highly recommend
it.
Thank you. A lot of our listeners are memoir writers or want to be, and it's a book you'll learn a lot, not only about Nahid and her culture, Persian culture, and the difficulties for women in that culture, but you'll also learn a lot about the structure that Nahid's talking about. Now, one of your newest books, the newest one that we can access, is a novella, and that's interesting to me because you have short stories and you have memoir. And where does a novella fit in? How did you choose this one to be a novella? And maybe you could tell us what a novella is as well.
Okay, well, novella, not as short as a short story and not as long as a novel. Usually it's around like 45 or 50 or 60 or 70 pages. I just wanted to condense that experience I had. The setting of the novella is very different from the setting of my other novels, which they all take place in Iran. We were living in that complex, that row of apartments with a common backyard. My husband and I and my baby at the time were living in that exact complex. The description there is based on a real place, and the characters in the novella also are based more or less, not exactly, a lot of people who passed through there in different apartments. And she had the main character that I put there is not from Iran. She's American born, but she had traveled so much that she has an accent. And she also doesn't feel completely American because most of her life she had traveled with her parents who were stationed in different countries. So when she and her husband, their relationship fall apart and she moves into this building, she has triad custody of the child until they decide if they definitely want to get a divorce, she and her husband. It's like a trial period. And she was hoping she would find a kind of family among these people there who all had children, who all shared the backyard, and also a lot of them were stay-home mothers to take care of their children, and she thought she will have a sense of family there. As it turned out, there was a lot of unhappiness and a lot of conflicts going on there. And then at one point, her child disappears, and a lot of the novella also is her search of trying to find her panic, missing the child. And though it's like just a few hours of missing, overnight missing, it captures the terror of losing a child. I just selected a fragment from it, which is when the child disappears. So this is somewhere in the middle of the novella. The name of the main character, the narrator, is Zora. Her parents, who were American, had just heard that name while they were traveling in Turkey, so they called their daughter Zora. And Zora, because she identified so much more with those travels, like those other countries she had lived in, called her daughter Anar, which also is a Turkish name, meaning pomegranate, actually. So I'm going to read a fragment from that section. A cardinal flew over the bare tree outside of the kitchen window, pecked a few times, and flew away. Zora looked at the clock with its filigreed wooden frame she had purchased in Tangiers. It was 20 minutes past 12. Anar was almost always home by 10 after 12. Something could be holding her in the classroom. Since the Christmas break, things were a bit disoriented at the school. Zora tried to engage herself with the article that she was writing for the magazine she was working at, drank the rest of her coffee. It was 12:20. Don't panic, she said to herself. She and the other two girls must be together, walking slowly, looking at things they find on the ground. More minutes went by. The chirping of birds had lost its beauty and become menacing, giving cryptic messages. She got ready and walked to Parsons School. A few children were coming out of their school's red brick building, some going away with their sitters or parents. Zora rushed inside. Anar's classroom was in the middle of the long corridor on the first floor. Through its half-open door, she saw three children eating from their lunch boxes. She knew all three by sight. Next to them lay a lunchbox with neon flower stickers on it that was like Anar's. But the lunchbox was blue, not pink like Anar's. She went inside. Have you seen Anar? She asked the children who were still there. They looked at her in a distracted way. And then the curly-haired, lively girl, Chris, said, we put our paintings on the bulletin board together. Did you see her leave with anyone? Chris shook her head. Zora went to Miss Anderson's office on the other side of the corridor. She noticed several watercolor paintings pinned to a bulletin board. That must be the artwork Chris was referring to. One picture had Anar's name on it. It was of a white house surrounded by trees. Miss Anderson was eating a sandwich and talking on the phone at the same time. She put her hand on the receiver. Can I help you? She asked Zora. Anar didn't come home for lunch, Zora said, trying to keep panic out of her voice. Do you know if she left with one of the children? I'm not sure, Miss Anderson said. That's all I'm going to read from
okay.
that, because I'm going to have a little time to read a flash fiction that comes from my short story collection.
There are some questions, not questions so much as I'm going to tell you things I appreciate, and one question in the excerpt that you've just read. It is so beautifully detailed in the way that Zora would see her place, and it's new to her. She's just moved into it, so she hasn't lived there that long. And the details about the lunchbox and the stickers and the clock that she remembers getting, I think you said Tangiers, and the pacing about the time that it is and what she's trying to do, which is get back into her focus for her writing, but she's completely distracted by worry about where her daughter is. And I just really admire that way that you've made us feel like she feels by slowing down time and keeping us focused in even all the details. That what she looks at is the clock. What she sees outside are other kids whose lunchboxes are different colors than her daughter's. And I'm wondering how many years from the time you lived in that complex to the time you wrote this, how many years went by?
Actually, many, many years, like 10 years or so,
yeah.
Even a little more. Because actually, originally, I wanted to write a novel about all the characters in that complex. And I thought I would write first this novella about this particular character and family, and maybe eventually I will develop other characters in the same way, like each one like a novella form, and mm-hmm. put them all together, all taking place, like it would be like linked stories in the same backyard.
Uh-huh.
But I haven't gotten around to writing the rest of those yet, because I got distracted by the short stories I wrote,
uh-huh.
and you know, like, I just jump around a lot like that when I write.
Right, exactly. But I think it's a good idea, and I bet you will get to it.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Sheila is talking with Iranian-born fiction author and memoirist Nahid Rocklin about her books, including a new novella and collection of short stories.
How is your memory so detailed and clear about that backyard and all those characters? Do you think Did you take notes? Is it just that your memory? Is it that you can fictionalize?
Well, you know what? Actually, I had written a really, really rough draft at the time that I was living there. So a lot of the details were in the rough draft notes I had taken, actually by hand in a notebook. So when I decided to write it, there were a lot of things that I had written down in note form. And not only that, several times I have gone back to that location to just, not for the purpose of research, but I have had reasons to go to Boston and Cambridge. And some of those people, actually a few of them are still there. Oh. So I went inside and I had a lot of my memories came back, because once you are in that location, you remember a lot of things.
Well, it's very well drawn. And I just, before we leave our discussion of the novella, want to read this description that the Chicago Tribune wrote. The writing captures the gasping panic beautifully, a story about the flip side of love, the consuming fear of loss. And I just think that's a wonderful review. We really very quickly get into the mind of the character Zora by these details you've collected and remembered and refreshed your memory on. So thank you. And so before you read the flash piece, do you want to tell us about the inspiration for your collection of short stories and anything else you want to tell us about?
The short stories all have to have something to do with Iran. All the characters aren't from Iran, but there is always intermingling between Iranians and Americans. A lot of it has to do with Iranians who have lived in the U.S. for a while, but they just somehow don't feel they quite belong here. And a lot of them in the stories go back home to try to connect again with the past that they have left behind. It's a little bit like my novel Foreigner, which I don't know if you have read or not, which is about the narrator of Foreigner is a woman who comes in the United States to go to college, marries an American, and after a while she realizes what she has left behind is very strong hold on her all of a sudden, and her life here feels empty and sterile, and she goes back in the search for her own identity and past and trying to figure out where she really belongs. The title Foreigner applies. She feels foreign both in the U.S. and in Iran, like she doesn't know exactly where she belongs. And a lot of these short stories have similar types of themes. A lot of them go back to search for what they have left behind. A lot of them find their lives empty here. A lot of them, just for various reasons, they're restless and they're trying to capture something that would their lives meaning. So a lot of them revolve around these themes, and I have written them over many years and this collection, but I didn't write them all at the same time. Like, they were published, all of them have been published in different literary journals, and so this is like putting them all together in this collection. It's called A Way Home because, like, these characters are trying to find home in a way.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you selected the excerpt you're going to read right now?
This is a little bit different, actually. The flash fiction pieces don't quite fit in the theme I just described. They deal more with memory, like my memory, some of the disturbing memories of my past, which are based to some extent on what was real when I was a child growing up, and now suddenly they caught up with me, and I just wrote them in this flash fiction form because I just wanted to capture just those memories, just in a fragment of the memories, the way they came to me. So these are the only three things that are very short in the collection. The rest are just regular size short stories, like 10, 15 pages. So I read one of those three flash fiction pieces. When Shamsi and her two small children moved into some of the rooms in my aunt's house, they looked very poor. My aunt, the owner of the house, took pity on them and reduced the rent by 32 months a month. Wherever Shamsi went, her children followed her. One of her daughters, Zahra, the smaller of the two, was blind in one eye, and her other eye could only see vague shadows of things. In the mornings, her eyelashes were covered with pus, and the whites of her eyes were lined with red veins. No one knew how Shamsi suddenly began to acquire new possessions. She bought new clothes for herself and her children. She bought copper pots and pans, which she polished every day, and a faint smile began to lighten her sullen face. Then Zahra disappeared. No one saw her in the morning or at any other time, and the smile on Shamsi's face also disappeared. One day in my presence, Shamsi confessed everything to my aunt. There was a man who was interested in marrying her, but would not put up with a blind child. Shamsi had taken Zahra to a desert at the edge of Tehran and left her there. Zahra had resisted her destiny by crying after the receding silhouette of her mother. Shamsi ran and got into a jeep full of soldiers. The soldiers teased and flirted with her, but she had covered her face under her chador. I picture Zahra standing in the vast desert, listening to the vanishing echoes of her mother's footsteps, then waiting desperately for them to appear again, until other frightening images and echoes sweep over her.
That is a frightening experience. And you said that these flash pieces are your experiences, remembered experiences?
Yeah, they're remembered experiences. I mean, they're from my childhood, so they could be somewhat, like, distorted. But they captured the reality. I mean, they're not too distorted. But, of course, after so many years of memory, they're not very exact. But I remember this mother and child.
Well,
and what happened.
Yeah, it seems to me that this is partly that theme of, you know, when people don't know where they belong and people have had the experience of having to live in a different culture than the one they grew up in, we do remember things, and sometimes the things we remember are disturbing rather than the happy memories that we miss having. So I think it's exciting that you've put flash pieces in with your longer pieces, and they seem all of a piece to me emotionally. So
thank you.
Yeah, thank you for reading that. I'd like to switch gears. You've done a lot of teaching, and you've done a lot of submitting of your work, and you've also been a judge for prestigious writing contests. So I'm wondering, a lot of people who write can't stand the idea of going through the submission process. They don't understand what contests are about. They just need a little help understanding that part of their writing life. And I'm just wondering if you have some insights or advice for people who are interested in the what I call the administrative tasks of writing.
Yeah, I agree. That's a terrible part of being a writer when it comes to submitting your work. Because, first of all, you submit your work, obviously, because you want to get published. But the publishing world is so fluctuating all the time and is so random and so crazy. I remember some of my classmates when I had that Wallace Stegner Fellowship who got great admiration from everyone in the class. They got so much encouragement from all of us and the teachers. Once they graduated from that and went to the real world of publishing, they sent out their work and they didn't get the same kind of praise as they got in the classroom and just gave up writing because they were so frustrated and angry. They felt they weren't appreciated by whoever they are who are reading their work outside of the more literary type of classroom. So my feeling is this. There is going to be a lot of rejection along the way, and you have to just separate yourself from the aggravation that goes with it. Because, for instance, I'll give you another example. One of my friends who eventually published by Little Brown and a lot of major publishers used to tell me the way she handles, and I think this is good advice, the way she handles rejections is that what she did, she would just make a list of where she's going to send her short stories. At the time, she was just writing short stories. And she would view it as if she's a secretary handling this work. she would just make a long list, prepare at the time that I'm talking about. It was like 15 years ago. People just submitted by envelopes, not by email. So she had all the envelopes ready, all the letters of submission letter ready, and just would put them, maybe five in the mail, and if they all came back, she would go to the next five. And the very first short story we published, oddly, after like 50 rejections, was at the New Yorker, which is one of the hardest places to publish in. So the same story that had gone to 50 places got accepted at the New Yorker. So what I'm saying is that some of it depends on the taste of the editors at the time that they're looking for a certain thing and this happens to come to them. In fact, the New Yorker editor told her this will get accepted by us because it happened to be a gay narrator, and that was unusual in 10, 15 years ago. And so that was just a stroke of luck that editor wanted that very subject. I think every writer should think of themselves as if they're their own secretary, but detach themselves from, like a secretary handling somebody else's work. That's what they have to look at themselves.
And the good reminder that people have been published after so many rejections. You said 50. I know that there are some books or articles about writers and how many rejections some of their work have experienced, and it's like sometimes over 200. So
that's right.
Yeah. So,
and also I know other examples. For instance, someone I know 10, 15 years ago, a novel she had written had gone out with an agent to every possible place, got rejected. After 15 years that she had set it aside, she found another agent, and this agent placed it very easily and quickly. You never know why something is published, why and when and whatever. Everybody who wants to be a writer, they should realize it's going to be a long struggle. I mean, some people may be just lucky and they publish something very quickly, like as soon as they graduate from, say, some MFA program, they immediately publish. In fact, I was lucky with Foreigner because I had just come back from that Stanford program to New York. And it was placed very quickly by an agent at Norton, W.W. Norton. So that was a lucky stroke. But that's not what happens very often.
Nahid, our time together is over, and I think that this is a good note to end on, which is one of the ways in which you've been well-published and prolific is tenaciousness, standing up for your work.
Exactly.
And keeping it out there. And I can't wait to read the rest. I've read half of your novella. I'm excited to go home and read the rest of it, and I'll be looking for those short stories, and I hope our listeners will too. So thank you again so much.
Thank you so much for having me here.
It's been a pleasure, and we'll be in touch. And again, the website is www.nahidrachlin.com, NahidRachlin.
Thank you.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.